accepting of many styles. I only get critical when it's a style that might confuse or mislead someone.
Like if we would just put a plus without a plus one?
That's okay. That's style.
Okay.
You know, if you want to show a plus one chart, some people do it like that.
Yeah.
This is my style. This is another style, one plus.
One plus.
It's only my style to circle it. You don't have to circle it. I mean, I'm accepting of all these and trying to suggest that if you try your style with me, I'll probably be okay with that and take a lot of your word away.
Okay.
Okay. So, generalized amino acid, how would you start?
The carbon of the double bonded oxygen, the carbon of the C.
Okay, so you would start like that?
Yes.
With?
Does it look like an acid yet?
No.
No, it doesn't. Let's make it look like an acid. It's an amino acid.
So let's add an OH to that carbon.
And I've shown the bonds of that carboxyl group almost explicitly. I guess I left one understood between the O and the H.
Yeah.
You can condense it even more, and I'm still be accepting of it. Some people do this. Some people do this.
Whoa.
Those all mean the same thing.
Okay.
Those are just more condensed than that, where you don't show as many of the bonds explicitly. So, start to feel better about your style.
Yeah.
And let's keep going with this.
And then we have another carbon onto that carbon.
And if you use Greek letters, would this be the alpha carbon or the beta carbon?
The alpha.
It's the alpha carbon. Very, very good. Okay.
So then off of that alpha carbon, there's an R group. And a hydrogen.
And you could show the hydrogen explicitly attached by a bond, or you could erase it, something like that.
Okay. And then off of that, there's a nitrogen.
So attached to the alpha carbon, there's an amino group. This would be why some people call amino acids alpha amino acid. They call them alpha amino acids, meaning that the amino group is attached to the alpha carbon. And so now we're doing the amino part.
And then you can put two hydrogens on that.
And he says you can put two hydrogens on that. I could condense it like this, or if I like to see all the bonds, I might be able to do that. Okay, you could stop there.
And that would be correct?
Yes.
Okay, that's what they did.
Yeah.
I can't.
You were wondering why it was negative one.
She's got one that hasn't been altered in a while.
Let's go back and get that person their point back. I hope she didn't walk out.
Maybe that person who came back and got their point back.
They're 99%.
Okay,
that makes us feel better.
So you wouldn't mind if we didn't draw the electron pair on the nitrogen?
No, unshared pairs of electrons are often left understood. I've left them understood over here, too.
Okay.
I only get really critical about your style when it's confusing to someone else, misleading to someone else. Then it needs to be corrected.
Like if you had a better hydrogen in the group without it being a plus one.
Yeah, the class has heard me say that I do become critical if you don't know how to show charges appropriately. And if you put this without a plus one charge, I would have to wonder and I would penalize you. Do you know there's a charge there? Because if you don't, that's a serious deficiency. And it's, you know, a little bit misleading to not tell people. There's a charge there. Tell them, show it. And then, so the plus one charge, my style is to do it this way and to circle it. There's other styles for showing.
Am I correct in that I'm thinking that we didn't talk about the affibation of Zymogen? There's an old test question.
Where it comes up is right where we are in lecture now with the digestion of protein.
So there are some digestion of protein questions. We're safe from those at this point.
I told the class yesterday that I would not put objective 12, 13, and 14 on it. I got the exact numbers. 12, 13, and 14 are not in their heads. Those would be the ones on protein digestion, and I told the class they're not on the test. maybe I was being too much of a pusher over there, but it's okay. It's okay.
We're not upset with you.
Eventually, I'm going to play a little catch up. It won't be noticeable to you guys.
I just have one question. It seems like there's been some confusion from previous tests and just the semantics of the term secondary active transport and what you call active transport. Is that, would it be fair if you just described exactly what you want us to know in terms of secondary active transport and how to explain it directly?
Yeah, I'm glad you asked that because I have noticed some confusion among students where they feel like I need to hear it one certain way, but again, I'm more flexible than that.
Okay.
Secondary active transport is different than ordinary active transport.
Would that be called primary?
There's no such official term, primary active transport, but there's ordinary active transport, and then there's secondary active transport. Ordinary is not an official term either. I'm just trying to make a little bit of a distinction.
Yeah, right. Okay.
In ordinary active transport, you expect ATP to be spent by the transporter itself.
Right.
You expect the transporter itself to be an ATP agent. In secondary active transport, that's not true. So I'm starting to see a difference between them now.
Right.
And instead of the transporter spending ATP itself, the transporter spends a sodium gradient or some kind of gradient for secondary active transport. Most immediately, that's what the transporter spends or uses as its energy or power source rather than ATP.
The transporter spends it.
Yes. The transporter spends a gradient rather than spending ATP. That's how we say it. That's a good way to say it. ATP is spent in secondary active transport, but not by the transporter itself. It's spent by a pump that creates or maintains the gradient. Now, here's where I'm very flexible. I can choose whichever way you want to approach it. Students I found are getting worried about, do I want them to describe the pump first and the transporter second, or vice versa, the transporter first and the pump second? And why would it make any difference? I don't care. I don't care what you consider to be the second event here. In other words, it would be a perfectly good answer to say the pump has to create the gradient first, and then the active import of glucose can occur. Or it would be just as good of a perfectly good answer if you said the transporter imports glucose first using the sodium gradient, and then after that, to maintain the gradient, you're going to have to pump out sodium. I don't care which part you say first, happens first, in other words, as long as you say both parts of secondary active transport, as long as you describe both parts of secondary active transport. Does that help?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Was there more to your question than that?
That's really it.
Okay. Yeah, and it's a very good question because I've heard students worrying about, well, what's secondary to what? And it doesn't matter as long as you describe it all.
Yeah. That's great.
Digestion of starch. We were kind of talking about it in a group. Is the reason why it doesn't break down all parts of like a fiber necessarily have to do with the 1/6 linkages?
We didn't look in any detail at all at the structure of fiber.
Okay.
Other than for me to say that most dietary fiber is carbohydrate of a polysaccharide nature. In other words, very big molecules that consist of essentially sugar rings joined by glycosidic linkages. But I did not go any further than that to say what kinds of sugar rings. For example, it's not going to be just glucose. It's going to be all some weird ones you've never even heard of. Sugar rings that you find in fiber. And the glycosidic linkages would not be as simple as just 1/4s and 1/6s. There would be 1/3s and 1/2s and all that. But the basic idea I think you've got in your mind of sugar rings joined by glycosidic linkages. But what makes it be dietary fiber rather than something that you can digest and absorb is the fact that the glycosidic linkages are ones that your human enzymes will not catalyze hydrolysis of.
Are there certain, we're going to go into that more in detail later, is what you're saying basically, or is that one thing that's not?
It's really not on my agenda to ever make you an expert on dietary fiber molecules.
Okay.
If you are interested in that information, it's not hard to find and not hard to find.
Okay. Yeah, I was just going through and I saw something about that and I didn't know if that was going to be something we needed to know.
One of the most famous dietary fibers is rather simple. That's cellulose, where it is all glucose rings, but joined to each other by some linkages that go the wrong direction, you might say. Or being digestible by you.
Okay.
So cellulose is not digestible by your enzymes.
Okay. And I also had a question about the glycogen being, or actually I should say, like glucose from fats versus glucose from obviously carbohydrates. And being stored in your, you had some question on what's more accessible to us and why don't we use the energy from fats versus the energy from glycogen.
What you're reminding me of is that argument objective about why do we store any glycogen when fat is really worth more kilocalories per gram. Why store glycogen at all? Has more kilocalories per gram, and why not just store all our excess fuel as fat? And so I made the point one at a time for why glycogen stored would be better than fat stored in liver cells, and why glycogen stored would be better than fat stored in muscle cells. The two places that store significant amounts of glycogen. Cells and muscle cells, one at a time, why glycogen might be better than fat in those places. And if you want to take it from there?
I think more of my question, and I stated it weird, was about our body actually using it in a sense of it's easier to access glucose from.
That is where this goes.
Okay.
It is the same learning objective, I think, that I started on, that you're worried about. And where we go next with it is, okay, in the muscle, why is it better stored glycogen than fat? And I see you finding what I'm saying right here. Muscle stores fuel that it can use when it needs a fuel anaerobically, a fuel that it can use anaerobically. And the only fuel that can be used anaerobically is glucose. So if muscle's going to store a fuel that it can tap into when it needs a fuel that it can use anaerobically, which would be better, glycogen or fat? Well, from glycogen, you can get lots of glucose to be used anaerobically. From fat, not so much. You don't get much glucose at all from fat. You can make a little bit of glucose from the glycerol backbones of fat molecules. But most of the fat molecules are the fatty acids. And from a typical fatty acid, there aren't any carbons that can add to the number of carbons for making glucose. I'll say it this way, you can't make glucose from a typical fatty acid.
Okay, that was my question.
Do you want to hear myself?
Yeah, no, that was perfect. I couldn't remember what you said about the carbs.
I just have a quick question on that. How much ATP is around the cell? Like, how long would it last if you couldn't, if you didn't have any stored in fat and you didn't have any glycogen? So, how much ATP would you have?
And you're not going to let any nutrients come in from
no.
the blood. You're
no.
just going
yeah.
to shut down.
Right. How long would it last before they? I mean, is there any storage of that ATP? I mean, how much is floating around there?
It's not something I would know the answer to. And it's
certainly
a different answer for different types of cells.
Sure. Yeah.
And for muscle cells, it would depend greatly on whether the muscle cell is resting or exercising, how long its ATP that's there right now lasts. Cells in general, here's the concept that you reminded me of and that I find useful. Cells in general try to maintain a fairly constant level of ATP.
Right.
So if they start using their ATP faster than they're making ATP, they'll try and speed up their making of ATP to keep a constant level of ATP. And you're talking about not letting them make anymore,
right.
and just how long would what they have right now last. Sorry, I don't know.
Okay.
It would be a short amount of time. You're not going to last hours. You're going to last seconds or minutes.
Okay.
On the fed state, on objective number 8, which asks you to describe the digestion and absorption of triacylglycerols, I get sort of lost when the products are absorbed by the enterocytes. I don't know if you could just sort of summarize that portion of the process.
Yeah, to get into the enterocytes, we have to break some of the ester bonds in the fat so that the pieces absorbed into the enterocyte will be fatty acids and 2 monoacyl glycerols. Last part, I said, takes a while to digest and understand. It takes a while to understand the 2 monoacyl glycerol. Are you okay with that?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Then the enterocyte can put the triacyl glycerol molecules back together. It can reattach the fatty acids to the 2 monoacyl glycerols to make the triacyl glycerols. Then it's packaged. Triacyl glycerols are packaged inside the enterocyte with phospholipids, cholesterol ester, and protein to make very low density lipoprotein particles. Excuse me, trying to line up.
Okay.
I just let my mind turn off for a second and got me into trouble. I'm back. We're talking about fat and enterocytes, and so chylomicrons would be lipoproteins that are being listed.
Right, because it's dietary.
Yes, dietary fat would be the major component in the core of the chylomicron. We took some time looking at the chylomicron's structure, the monolayer on the surface, what kinds of molecules would be in that, and the core in the center, what kinds of molecules would be in that. Where do you want me to stop?
You're good, that's perfect. if I could just ask one more question. In the book, in figure 1.6, the drawing of a typical fatty acid, the fatty acid chains are very long. Do you want us to draw
Longer is more common.
Okay.
But if you major is shorter than the ones they show, I would not take off any credits. What I might be looking for is that you realize it's an even number of carbons.
Okay.
But I know I pulled the class that much about typical fatty acid, that it's an even number of carbons. But whereas that picture in the book might have shown fatty acids that are 18 and 16 carbons long, it would be fine if you showed some that are 8 and 10 carbons long. And you can condense the carbon chain by showing CH2 taken as many times as you want in parentheses like this. So if I wanted to make it look 18 carbons long, it wouldn't have taken me any more than that to make it look 18 carbons long. That's not that elaborate, I don't think.
No.
Okay. So, Ron here, if it's a connection to the glycerol backbone, would be an ester bond to an oxygen of the glycerol backbone.
And the oxygen stays with the glycerol.
Yes. When hydrolysis of that ester bond occurs, this oxygen remains with the glycerol. Yes, and becomes the oxygen of the OH group of glycerol. So
did he drop glycerol?
Yeah. Use more of the blackboard. So, as I draw glycerol, I'm not tapping into a picture in my mind that I've memorized. Instead, I'm tapping into some concepts about what I want to draw and making it be a series of thoughts, logical thoughts, rather than a picture I memorized. Glycerol has three carbons, and it's an alcohol at all three places. Those are the concepts I need to draw at, I think. I'm so used to putting it vertically that maybe I want to switch it up a little bit this time and make it horizontal.
Yeah.
Or
diagonal.
Yeah. Or how about if you did it in a curve? No, it's not that crazy.
That would be way too crazy for me.
But then to make it look like an alcohol in all three places means to show an OH group in all three places and which direction they point doesn't really matter.
And then it's just another oxygen, and that's what forms that ester bond.
Well, you wanted just glycerol by itself.
Right. Yeah.
So that's all the oxygens I'm going to show.
That's glycerol.
And what I still feel is unfinished about this picture is the carbons that don't look like they have four bonds.
Yeah.
So
H2.
Let's put enough hydrogens on every carbon to make it look like four bonds. You don't really have to show the bonds as explicitly as this. You could condense it something like that. We're seeing four bonds to that carbon now.
Yeah.
Different styles allowed. And now I'm seeing four bonds for all carbons. I hope you realize that I would have accepted other ways for that to appear in how I said it. Is there anything you're wondering about when it comes to your style that I find it acceptable? Let me see. Let me see your style.
Except just like the bar? Like, maybe I just do like a bar without an H?
A bar?
Like, you know how there's the
thing?
Yeah, that's the best way to let me see your style is to draw.
Usually, I think I just go like this.
Oh, yeah. A bond from a carbon a bond from a carbon to nothing would be interpreted by anyone to mean a bond to a hydrogen. Yeah. Okay, style too. Now, I do use a grater. And if you feel like the style that you crew wasn't treated fairly by the grader, then come to me, appeal to me. If you had done that and the grader went, oh, I don't know what's here, and I'm going to do not appoint, then I'd give that point back to you. The grader that I'm using for this class this year is the same grader that I used for this class last year, so they've got some experience under the belt.
So just if you were to make that the glycerol backbone for triacyl glycerol, you would remove a hydrogen?
Yeah, so that we could have ester bonds. So adding acids helps that for an abbreviated style. There's the fatty acids.
Just write P then. Okay. So is that an acceptable style?
I suppose. Yeah. It ain't pretty, but it's a good point. The picture of the triacyl glycerol in the textbook. Say this figure 1.6 has the glycerol backbone vertically, has that oxygen on the right, and this oxygen on the left, and this oxygen on the right, as I recall. In other words, the fatty acids are on the right up at the top, and on the left at the middle. And on the right at the bottom. And I often find students worrying it doesn't have to be exactly that way. No. You can make them all three point to the left if you want, for example.
Is LPL the one that breaks the fatty acids away from the glycerol backbone in the adipose on the capillary wall?
Yes.
Okay, that's the one that does that.
Well, now you call it LPL until you know what that stands for.
Is it? I know. Is it a lipoprotein lipase? Or something?
Yeah, it's lipoprotein or lipoprotein lipase.
Okay.
What's so nice maybe about saying the full name is that now you know it works on lipoproteins.
So a lipoprotein, what is a lipoprotein?
You know two kinds of lipoproteins thus far, the LDLs, which stands for
of course you know this answer.
But I also like to be challenged from time to time, and I get used to using acronyms all the time. The LDLs are kind of microns of the lipoproteins that you know thus far. At least the LDLs tell you in their name that they are lipoproteins. So it's maybe the kind of microns that are a little bit trickier to realize. Those are lipoproteins. Remember the same picture was used to describe both the LDLs and chylomicrons in class. They're both lipoproteins. They both have that core of very hydrophobic molecules and that monolayer of amphibathic molecules on the surface. They are packages. They're not cells. Sometimes students get it in their minds that they're cells. No, they're not. They're packages for transporting lipid in the bloodstream. That's what they are, is in the bloodstream. this would help drive home that point. When a doctor, physician, talks about the triglycerides in a patient's blood, now you guys know where they are. They're inside the LDLs, and they're inside chylomicrons. Those are the triglyceride-rich lipoproteins in the blood. So that's what's really being measured when triglycerides in a patient's blood are measured. They're looking at the LDLs and chylomicrons. That's where the triglycerides are.
It's mostly in the LDLs because chylomicrons are dietary, unless they've just eaten a really fatty meal, the ones that are just kind of floating around.
Well, if there was fat in the meal, there'd be some chylomicrons too.
Okay.
But if somebody
they're both
really
fed state things. The chylomicrons and the LDLs are both produced in a fed state from different components of the meal. And in two different places, the LDLs being made from sugar in liver cells, and the chylomicrons being made from fat in enterocytes.
So when they measure that, do they count just an overall number? Or do they look at volume, or do they averaging how many fat molecules are inside each one? I mean, what do they do?
I'm not sure. I haven't checked on
just
the
sort
clinical
of
science there enough to know how the test is done. A variety of possibilities along the lines of what you were mentioning come to mind, and you have to look to see which one they use.
Okay. This is kind of interesting.
It's a similar comment coming up when we talk about the lipoproteins that carry cholesterol. When people talk about the cholesterol level in their blood, it's not cholesterol floating by itself. It's cholesterol inside lipoproteins. That's what's being measured. And then you would ask me, well, do they measure the number of lipoproteins, or do they measure the volume of cholesterol, or again, bring myself up to date on the clinical lab chemistry there.
But the overall size of all those different packaging, those are all pretty uniform? Like each protein keeps it to a specific size of the package?
The chylomicrons are the biggest. And HDLs, high density lipoproteins, are the smallest. And what makes the HDLs so dense largely is the protein content, being a high protein content. So the different kinds of lipoproteins have different amounts of protein in them, and different densities and different sizes.
So a VLDL would have a high concentration of lipids, right?
Okay.
So they're
the main component of a VLDL. This would be a possible question, since I remember making a point about it in class. The main component of a VLDL is triacylglycerol. And would it be dietary triacylglycerol or endogenous?
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sitting here until 6. I don't get picked up, so. Until 6, so.
So we'll probably be, we're going to be going more into detail of digestion, like not necessarily digestion, but absorption of fats and carbohydrates and sort of in the body like that.
When we're done with the digestion and absorption of fats and carbohydrates, the one that we still have to do is digestion and absorption of protein.
Protein.
And that's where we are right now.
And but we'll be going more into like glycolysis.
Oh, yes.
And that.
The pathways and the enzymes and, yeah, that's all coming. After the fasting state, and maybe you would say even in the fasting state, the fast gets harder.
Yeah, okay. And I did have another question, actually. Is the glucose-6-phosphatase in the liver, that's the only reason why they can do gluconeogenesis, correct?
Yes. That would be for the very last step of gluconeogenesis, where the glucose is made exportable.
Right.
You
want to take it
Okay.
Yeah.
And I remember you saying something about glycogenolysis? Is it glycogenolysis? Okay, I don't want to say
that's,
it.
That's an official term. I'm wondering what you heard me say. Glycogenolysis. You hear glycogen in that?
Yeah. So it's just the breakdown of glucose from glycogen?
From glycogen, the breakdown of glycogen. So yeah, it sounds like you were able to get that from the word.
Yeah.
That's ideal, that the word tells you that.
Yeah, and do we need to know any more detail than it happening in the liver and
where else?
In the muscle.
Yeah. I'm expecting you to have those basics. The steps of glycogenolysis are coming later.
Okay. And also to certain enzymes, do you want us to know the basic enzymes of the glycolysis, oxidation, phosphorylation?
We haven't looked at them yet.
No.
Those chapters are coming up on the syllabus. So enzymes that I've mentioned thus far, I've mentioned phosphatases. And some of the digestive enzymes.
Yeah, like pepsin.
We didn't even get to pepsin yet.
I thought we were talking about it being an amino breaking down protein in the stomach, no?
I'm not surprised if you previewed that already. And I got right up to that point in the far, but I haven't done it yet.
Okay, so you're saying just the proteins we haven't got to trypsin and
That kind of stuff I think is objective 12.
Yeah, I know, I did see it. I couldn't remember if that was something we went over quickly. But breaking down carbs and fat enzymes involved in that,
all the way through
salivary amylase and pancreas.
I'm not sure I'm saying those numbers correctly.
Oh, for the patients?
No, that's injections.
Oh.
I don't want to.
12, 13, 14 is what you said in class.
Yeah, you did
say
that.
I need a triple check. That's correct.
Okay, perfect. Thank you.
Do we need to know what sugars make up the different disaccharides and polysaccharides?
Yes.
So we need to know this one has glucose and galactose.
Yes.
Okay.
And since it sounds like you just mentioned lactose,
right.
I would want you to know that the glycosidic linkage comes from the galactose's carbon number 1.
Okay.
And goes to the glucose is carbon number 4.
That's good.
4, okay, that one's definitely right.
That's getting kind of detailed, but I did do that in class.
Right.
I didn't show that much detail in class.
I'm sure you know the structure of glucose. What about, do we need to show the structure of like galactose, how it's different than glucose?
That might be fair only for extra credit.
Okay.
I think I mentioned. mentioned once and quickly that the lactose and glucose differ right here at carbon 4, and I pointed out.
Right, right. Okay. So and just
did you think that I would make you draw glucose rings? Because I wouldn't.
Okay. Oh, well, I wasn't sure if you'd say, you know, fill in this for glucose or...
No,
tell me that there's an oxygen in here and not at this
point. I'm being very patient before I make you be able to draw the those things.
Okay.
That won't happen until the third quarter. Okay. But then third quarter, you get so good at drawing sugar rings that you develop some bravado sort of like, give me any sugar ring in the world that you want, give me any sugar that you want, and I can draw it in a five-membered ring or a six-membered ring. Just tell me which you want.
Or linear.
So in sucrose, I mean the one carbon number is very involved in glucose and fructose. Is it just carbon numbers?
It's number one for the glucose, but number two for the fructose. The fructose ring does not have carbon number one as a ring member. That's carbon number two is a ring member, but not carbon number one.
Well, so that's where we come from. We come from the...
carbon two. Not acted on at all by your human enzymes.
Gotcha, but the bacteria.
Some of the bacteria have enzymes that can act chemically on dietary fiber. And it can lead to the formation of some products that are actually beneficial to the lining of your colon.
Really?
Yeah. That's what I had in mind when I put that in the learning objective, is that I would tell the class about these short-chain fatty acids that gut bacteria make from fiber, and that these short-chain fatty acids that are beneficial to your colon lining.
How is it beneficial?
Actually,
incorporate them in the membrane?
Colonocytes, I'll call them, because enterocytes are in the small intestine, the colon in the large intestine. The colonocytes will take in the short-chain fatty acids and use them as fuel. And I think there's more to it than that. The short-chain fatty acids influence gene expression in the colonocytes in a way that help the colonocytes differentiate properly. And this might help prevent colon cancer.
Wow, that's really interesting.
So they have like a G protein or something that would bind one of those and then stimulate DNA.
I'm thinking of like a transcription factor.
Right, right.
To describe a protein that would bind to DNA.
But something I was just thinking of something that binds one of these short-chain fatty acids that would cause some time, you know, signaling cascade or whatever, and then would cause a transcription factor. So
something
like
those lines. I picture probably this scenario where the short-chain fatty acids bind to some proteins that can then bind to DNA. And some naturopath.
butyrate to improve the health of the colon. Butyrate enemas, or maybe taking butyrate capsules by now. Some naturopathic protocols would use butyrate, and here's the dots I need to connect for you for you to appreciate what I'm saying there. Butyrate is a short chain of amino acids.
Four
carbons long. That's kind of short for a fatty acid.
And how come they just use butyrate? You know, that's just the most effective, or how come they don't have like
there's more research about that one. Mm-hmm. Maybe it is the most effective as well, but I'm open to the possibility that something a little shorter or a little longer might be just as good.
Mm-hmm.
Like propionic acid is 3 carbons long, and that's a short chain fatty acid, and I think it might be just as good as butyrate.
So they don't necessarily have to be even.
Right. The typical fatty acid in nature is an even number of carbons, but not all fatty acids are. There are some exceptions.
Why are they even numbered?
What's because they're made 2 carbons at a time.
Okay. I got you. Okay.
So start off at 2 carbons, you add 2 more, mm-hmm. you add 2 more, you add, you probably got an even number there.
So the colonocytes actually synthesize these fatty acids from the dietary fiber?
No. What we were saying is that the bacteria or flora in your gut make the short-chain fatty acids from fiber. Even though you weren't able to act on the fiber with your own enzymes, your gut bacteria were able to act on the fiber and make these short-chain fatty acids. So first, the short-chain fatty acids appear in the lumen of the colon, and then the colonocytes take in the short chain fatty acids. I'm so aware of the fact that I did not tell the class that about the short chain fatty acids, but that won't be on the test.
Oh, that's a jinx.
He can still be proud of your knowledge.
I mean, I was actually looking at the questions, the sample questions, and I saw that did I hear that, or did I just turn out that was chromium?
Well, if I was sure it was clearly explained in the book, it would still be a fair question. I mean, we've been through those learning objectives. I don't have to say everything. And it would have been a fair question, I feel, if it was clearly explained in the book. But I don't think it is. I think that was information that I added to the book in the past. So I don't think it would be fair.
There's a lot of describe, whatever, how detailed do you expect that to be? And I know that's a vague question. That's why I waited a few minutes to ask that. I'm trying to think of how to voice it better, and I can't think of a way. So, for example, describe the structure of a generalized lipoprotein such as the LDL particle or chymerin.
I would say, first of all, that there would be 2 general approaches in my mind to answer what you just said. So the question before me is describe the structure of a VLDL or chymerin. One way to answer that would be with a well-worded paragraph. Mm-hmm. Another way to answer that would be just as good, would be with a well-labeled diagram and drawing. That's a general comment about discussion questions or essay questions. A well-labeled, and that's a key qualifier here, a well-labeled diagram can be just as good as a well-worded paragraph.
Okay.
it's with your labeling that you can make a diagram have all the words.
Mm-hmm. A lot quicker, though. Do you think time's going to be a factor?
It will be for some people.
So we could make a diagram that might save us some time.
Might save us some time. I agree.
Okay.
If you're especially worried about your sentence structure and you keep rewriting what you wrote, then draw a picture.
Sure.
How do you draw a picture of the idea? I mean, that's a similar thing with the tails and everything.
I don't think you have to get three-dimensional in your drawing. You can make it look like a circle, like a cross-section through the middle of one, and show the mono layer, and then what's in the core. Labeling the kinds of molecules that you find in those places. That would be a way to diagram, I think. The triacylglycerols.
Walls?
Yes. If you're going to say triacyl, then the way to end that is glycerols. If you say triglycerides, it ends with an ides. But triacyl glycerols means the same thing as triglycerides. Try not to mix up the endings. In the core, I would expect to see triacylglycerols and cholesterol esters. And in the surface layer, I would expect phospholipids, cholesterol, and proteins.
Would we have to know, the apical protein
B100 versus apoprotein B48.
Oh my god, I remember that.
Possible for extra credit.
What?
When I throw out a little fact like that in lecture and I'm trying to search for extra credit questions, those are things I tend to choose.
Okay. Sorry, I didn't catch that. What did you say?
He was saying, that surface layer to have proteins and cholesterol and stuff. No, it's even proteins. What is he talking about? Proteins. And I remembered the picture of the worm-looking thing that struck me during lecture, and I was like, what is that thing? And I was like, oh, it's a protein. Oh, it's apoprotein B48.
The picture in the book is a picture of a VLDL when you read the caption, and the wormy-looking protein is labeled ApoB100.
What's
I was using the same picture, however, to describe chylomicrons. And I said one slight difference, if this was a chylomicron, would be that if it was a chylomicron, instead of ApoB100, it would have ApoB48. You see, enterocytes make ApoB48 versus liver cells make ApoB100.
What's funny about that is that it's the number of the protein smaller, but you'd expect it to be bigger because the chylomicrons are bigger. So I expect it to be 4,800 or 1,000. I don't know why that is. I don't know how they number it, but.
Yeah, you seem to really feel that the proteins are going to determine the size of the lipoprotein. I remember you and I having that conversation.
I was just wondering how variable it is between these different structures and if the proteins will kind of keep it the right size so that it always has this amount of fats or whatever inside.
Well, their sizes undergo change while they're in the bloodstream.
Mm-hmm.
We've talked about the VLDLs and the chylomicrons as delivering from what's in their core. And so as they deliver some of their cargo, they get smaller. And the cargo that they're letting go of is some of their least dense parts. So So they get smaller and denser while they're in circulation.
What's causing them to release their cargo?
Lipoprotein lipase. That's the enzyme on the inner walls of the capillaries.
So as it's hitting, it's just taking a little bit
right. Each
time. Huh?
Each time, that's right. I haven't described that to the class, but you did it well. Just a little here and a little there.
Yeah.
Each time it gets a little smaller.
Yeah, you can.
describing, I just made an ATP ADP cycle because I realize now, and I think this is probably not enough, but it had some byproducts and water and stuff in there.
Well, the picture in the book has a lot more information than what we included here.
Yes.
For example, the picture in the book would tell me what kinds of processes are involved other than just ATP synthase and putting these back together. I mean, didn't you have to burn some fuel or something?
Well, all you need is a proton pump. All you need is a gradient, right? However that thing got there.
So to make any of that work, you have to send some electrons to the electron, you've got to oxidize some fuel right out of it. So I would look at the information that's in their picture that you haven't included here and decide a way to include that information. It doesn't have to look just like the book's picture, but something about cellular respiration or something that would indicate using fuel. And then for the other side of the circle, well, what's being accomplished by breaking ATP into these two pieces? You don't show me anything being accomplished by that.
Right, synthesis.
And it's really not a phosphatase, perhaps,
I wondered about that.
It's really possible, but I don't want you to really think that would have to be a phosphatase. For example, we talked about the myosin ATPase as catalyzing that reaction when muscle contraction
happens. Yeah, but isn't that specific to muscle?
Yeah, so you want to mention muscle contraction, and then what else came to your mind just now?
Let me tell you.
Now we're getting somewhere.
Yeah.
like transporting things across the membrane.
Put that into your diagram.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Active ion transport. It's on the list.
That's true.
So the idea of that diagram in my mind was on one side you see how energy is created, and on the other side you see how energy is used by cells.
So that would be another good question where you could just draw this diagram like this and set a list of fuels and a list of uses and then have oxygen coming in, CO2 coming out.
Yeah, if I took the learning objective verbatim, describe the ATP-ADP cycle, you can answer that with a paragraph or a
diagram. That would be nice. That, to me, it's, I don't know why, it's a lot easier than writing it all out. Because you're going to tell this whole story that you're going to go through that would just take like that much.
I agree with this caveat. Make your diagrams well labeled.
Right.
That's the way to get all the information in.
Well, yeah, you have to say in your paragraph everything too. Exactly. Make sure you don't leave it out. So.
Okay. I just want to know how much information do you want when you say describe the use of error glycogen? And why store glycogen in liver? Because I'm thinking that there's just one answer to that, is just to maintain the glucose levels in the blood.
Yeah. That's a pretty short answer. that one's not all that involved. Liver glycogen is for blood sugar.
Right, and you could contrast that with why you wouldn't put that in fat, because that's not going to help you get sugar. Help you get energy without sugar in the blood.
What he's saying is that the question might be, why is glycogen better than fat when it comes to storing in the liver. And you would say that glycogen is a better source of glucose for the blood than fat.
It's faster. Yes.
It might be.
he said earlier that the only glucose you get from fats would be from the glycerol backbone, so you can put together all the rest of it just for energy
very few carbons in a fat that can be used for building glucose. But all the carbons in glycogen kind of already are.
And for muscles, it's just to supply glucose for anaerobic use during exertion. As in, you know.
When you say that anaerobic use part, that makes it a good answer.
And the same reason involved.
Yeah, because we're back to which one's a better source of glucose, really. Your glycogen is a much better source of glucose. But make it part of your answer how the liver is different than the muscle when it comes to the use of this glucose. For the liver, you want to mention something about glucose for blood sugar. And in the muscle, you want to say something about glucose that would be a fuel that can be used anaerobically.
And
then I don't have to mention the products of anaerobic use of glucose. But what is that main product that would come to mind that's the result of anaerobic use of glucose?
Well, ATP and lactate.
Yeah. I was only thinking of the lactate, but I like the way you include it.
On the ATP-ADP cycle diagram, there's like O2 going in and CO2 going out when it goes from ADP to ATP. But isn't that only when you're speaking aerobically?
Yeah, that box on the left side is really about aerobic use of those fuels.
Mm-hmm. Oh, anaerobically going through those, right?
Right.
Oh, okay.
I might sum up that box on the left by calling it cellular respiration. O2 goes in, CO2 comes out, and it allows ADP and PCI to be put together and make ATP. What does ATP stand for?
I didn't check on that.
You were so ready for that. And now you've seen how that describes all of the structure, the adenosine product you were circling it for me a minute ago, and then three phosphates. Adenosine and triphosphate.
Yeah. The question is, do red blood cells have mitochondria?
No.
Okay.
By the time they are in circulation in the bloodstream, we would call them erythrocytes, or red blood cells. And they do not have mitochondria anymore. They did when they were first developing in the bone marrow. And they had other names back then, erythroblasts or something like that. But by the time there are erythrocytes, or what I would call mature red blood cells in circulation, not have any mitochondria anymore, nor do they have a nucleus. They don't have a nucleus anymore. They used to, they don't anymore.
So they don't need to do any protein synthesis at all?
Right, they can't. They're only going to last about 120 days and then they will be chewed up probably in the spleen.
The whole TCA cycle is also called oxidative phosphorylation, is that right? Or is it just part of that?
Neither.
Oh.
The TCA cycle precedes oxidative phosphorylation.
So that's a specific, like, stick in the phosphate binder, is that oxidative phosphorylation?
That's the phosphorylation part of oxidative phosphorylation. The oxidative part of oxidative phosphorylation is the electron transport
cycle.
Oxidative phosphorylation starts with the electron transport chain and ends with ATP synthase into ATP. Tell me the Latin just went on.
Well, I was just thinking, like, I was putting TCA cycle as the whole thing, not the one part where they make pyruvate and all the, there's all the stuff.
The TCA cycle is only the part that you see acetylcholine going in.
Right.
And there's some carbon dioxide coming out.
Right.
And some electrons coming out.
Oh, okay.
That's the TCA cycle.
So
don't back up all the way through pyruvate.
Okay.
The TCA cycle starts with the acetyl-CoA going on.
Okay. I've had this in many classes.
I know.
It always intimidated me to the point where I don't even study it. Like, I can study an epitaph test, but this time is different. Yeah, I was trying to get it. Well, this is grad school. I care about this.
And so what do you call the part that goes from glucose to pyruvate? That's glycolysis.
Oh.
And then you got the linking step to bring it in.
That's very good.
And you don't do that in bacteria. So bacteria is more efficient than us. It costs ATP to do that. I remember that.
So what do you call the whole thing then? Is there an answer to glycolysis plus TCA?
Cellular respiration?
Oh, right.
They're more efficient than us in terms of getting more energy out of glucose. They get like 34 ATP per molecule because we spend an ATP to get the pyruvate across the membrane and the inner mitochondrial membrane, but they don't have one of those, so they actually just put it outside in the space, and then they have a little bit of proteins that kind of keep the environment, to keep the protons out there, but basically they only have one membrane, so they don't have to transport it. So we pay to transport it, basically.
So they do that at the electron transport chain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, they're kind of... That's kind of what a mitochondria is.